This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you. Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real life store stage, all the way to the, hey Marge, did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Running a growing business means getting the insights you need wherever you are. With Shopify's single dashboard, you can manage orders, shipping, and payments from anywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ifanboy, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ifanboy now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/ifanboy. This is iFanboy Booksplode, Batman by Neil Adams, Book 3.
When you're down and troubled and you need a helping hand and nothing, oh, nothing is going right, close your eyes and and soon I will be there to brighten up even your darkest night.
Hello, welcome to Booksplode. My name is Connor Kilpatrick, and I am here with Josh Flanagan.
That is me. You got that correct.
And this is Booksplode, our bi-monthly podcast that was unlocked by the patrons at patreon.com/ifanboy, in which Josh and I, or sometimes special guests, take a look at a graphic novel, a collection, an original graphic novel, a old collection, something bigger than your regular comic book. And last year, in 2019, we spent most of that year re-examining the 90s, reading again stories we had read in our youth and or we'd never read, but mostly from the 90s period. And as we came into this year, we thought, well, what are we going to do? Let's jump to the 70s, because that's mostly a blind spot. You know, we were born in the 70s, so we didn't read a lot of 70s comics, or as many as other decades, so we figured let's try that out.
I think we're aware of the names and the trends and the, you know, how things went then, but I don't think we've ever really read a lot of it.
Or at least explored a lot on the various iFanboy outlets. Mm-hmm.
Yes, that's true.
Josh may be immediately regretting that decision. We'll get to that on the show. We're talking about this book, which is a collection from DC. It's book three. We thought it'd be fun at least to jump into the third book in the series, not the first, because those comics back then were designed that way.
And that absolutely held true, by the way. There's no like, oh man, I hadn't read the first two books. I'm lost.
So this is a series of that features the artwork of Neil Adams, and it features mostly the stories by Denny O'Neil and inks by Dick Giordano, although the last... Did I say Giordano? Giordano.
You did. Yeah.
This is literally the first time I've spoken out loud today.
I think Giordano was the uncle of the guy from the Lemonheads.
So, and then the last two stories in this book, which we'll talk about, were written by Neil Adams and also inked by him. Actually, I'm really glad we did this volume because it's very Ra's al Ghul heavy. And it, spoilers for your 40-year-old comics.
No, I don't think there's any spoiler warning needed for this. That's I'm going to go ahead and just say, let's not, you know what, it doesn't apply.
So they're very Ra's al Ghul heavy. In fact, this collection features the first appearance of Ra's al Ghul. And as a kid in the 80s, these are a lot of the comics I read. I didn't read these specific comics. I actually read one or two of these specific comics that are in this collection. But when I was a kid and going to the comic store, I didn't go in and buy new comics. I would go into the back issue bin and buy older Bronze Age stuff. And so a lot of this era is the era that I read, or at least had issues from. So this felt very much like a warm Batman blanket.
Almost. It was as if somebody took your warm Batman blanket and then dyed it in new colors that ruined it.
Let's talk about that in a second. And this is your more globe-trotting Batman. A lot of this it's international. He's at ski chalets. He's at Ra's al Ghul's fortresses all across the globe. A lot of romance with Talia. That's where I think a lot of my feelings about him being with Talia instead of Catwoman come from. And also a lot of Batman and Robin together as a team, which is basically non-existent now.
Yeah.
And has been non-existent for decades. So this felt great to read, even if you have to recalibrate your mind into what you're reading. And I had forgotten what an asshole Batman was. But let's talk about what you just mentioned, which is that it's recolored.
And I think that it's sort of, we're going to mention it as a preamble, and I'm not going to go back to it. But it was the very first thing I noticed as I started reading, and I was like, this is not period correct color.
No.
And I get it. Maybe there's even technical printing reasons why that's the case. But what I don't really like at all is that there's no mention of it. There's no colorists mentioned anywhere in it. Right. They're not crediting the person who came back through and recolored it.
Maybe they took their name off it because it's bad.
Right, because they know. They were like, I'll take the job, but don't tell anyone I did this. Like, it's like a Vinnie Coletta for hire. And it's wrong. And it's funny
really
because...
It's bad. I mean, I think actually it might be better as it goes because...
I was going to say it's worse as it goes.
Oh, really?
You know what? It faded in and out. That's what I noticed. Yeah. Like, sometimes I was like, this isn't so bad. And then it would go back. You know, but it's telling to me that the cover is recolored, I think. It's got the highlights in it, like the digital highlights. But yeah, there's bits. If you look at like the title page, that looks more like it should. Like the blue is blue.
Yeah.
And I just feel like this stuff was inked and drawn with that in mind. And so therefore.
The shading, all this shading and highlighting, it's jarring.
It's subtractive, not additive.
I keep looking at page 10 on your digital reader. I think the picture you sent me originally with the brow of Ra's al Ghul.
Yeah.
It's just, I realize this is like standard operating procedure, especially at DC for these old collections. For some reason, they feel like they have to be recolored. And maybe it is a production reason. Maybe the colors are lost. Maybe they can't print them. Who knows? But they could also.
And the way they did colors back then, I still don't understand. With color separation, blah, blah, blah.
But they could recolor them in a style that matches the old coloring.
Yes.
And
exactly.
They choose not to do that, and it's a real detriment to the art. Even somebody like Neil Adams, who draws much more in a modern style than other artists at the time, it still doesn't work. And it's very much like the Star Wars special editions. When I watch those, I want to watch them as they were originally on the screen, not all spiffied out. Although I do like watching the Star Trek with the special effects, so who knows. But here, I'd rather read the comics as they were published.
And if you go through the back, there's a huge cover gallery. And it's the coloring. I think it's mostly the coloring from then. It's more like flat color. And it just looks so much better. It just looks so much better. Neil Adams draw and I'm going to give a ton of credit to Dick Giordano, I think.
Yeah,
a ton. You know, they draw in such a texture, the way that people don't draw anymore because they have the colorists where, you know, all that sort of shading and crosshatching and bits, you know, that created the 3D effect. That created the shapes. That created the light.
Yep.
And that was enough. And I loved it.
It's important to talk about because it does affect the book in a certain way, for sure.
Yeah, and you're not getting a real historical view of what the stuff was.
It's not a document anymore. It's not a historical document anymore because it's changed. It's unfortunate, and that seems to be standard operating procedure for DC, and I would love to talk to someone to find out if there's a reason why or if that's just if someone in charge feels that's the aesthetic they should do. But I can't imagine that anyone who is buying a collection of 70s Batman comics would then feel turned off if the coloring wasn't modern. I can't imagine
Well, I mean, we lived through the era where, you know, Ted Turner thought that nobody would watch old movies unless he colored them. So
he's a monster.
I know.
it's the same thing. Like, if I'm watching an old movie, I want to watch it as originally presented, not with weird painted coloring on it.
So let's talk about the work as best we're able.
Yeah. So this features 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 stories in its 200 and how many pages? This is 266 pages. And then I love the cover gallery at the end. That's one of my favorite parts of the whole book.
It was the best part of the whole thing. The covers were amazing. There was several of them where I just like, oh, this is, you know, and they were all very like pulpy and like,
well, we talk about covers
now. Is Superman dying?
How they're just, pinups. And I understand there's a reason for it because they're often done before the books are even written and drawn. But like those covers told stories. You really got a sense of what you were in for from those covers. And they were dramatic. And everyone was always dying on them. You know, Robin's getting shot.
Yeah.
Superman's dead. Like, and then, of course, there's a swerve in the story where that doesn't happen. But it's just, it felt so much more dynamic than what you get now, which is just, here's pinup of character in the book. Robin's constantly dying on the covers. In fact, I started keeping a record of covers that I find in which Robin is thought to be dead, including this one where he's being shot. And then he gets shot in the very first page, so I guess that works.
There's over 30 pages of covers, and it doesn't get old.
No, I loved it. It kept going, and I was like, this is so good. So in the first story here, and I'm not going to go through all of them, but the first story is the one where Ra's al Ghul makes his first appearance, and it's Robin has been kidnapped. Batman goes to investigate, and he is confronted in his Batcave by Ra's al Ghul and Ubu, who Batman really hates, who's Ra's al Ghul's, you know, henchman. And his daughter has been kidnapped, his daughter Talia, who he had met first. She first appeared, and then an issue later, Ra's al Ghul appeared. So Batman...
Yeah, that was a question I had.
Yep. So Batman knew who she was from previous issue. And so Robin has been kidnapped, Talia's been kidnapped, so Batman and Ra's al Ghul must work together to figure out what has happened in this story. And this is a very international globetrotting Batman and Ra's al Ghul story. You know, Batman's in snow gear, and they're in, like, what city is that they're in where they get attacked by the leopard? Calcutta. They're all over the map trying to find where their loved ones have gone. So what did you think when you first, like, the opening story, not having read these kind of things before?
I spent a little time orienting myself. I kind of enjoyed it, but I definitely thought, boy, this is a lot of words. And, you know, I think you mentioned at the beginning, like, it takes a little while to orient yourself to the style of the time. Mm-hmm. And you sort of go, well, I can kind of skim this bit. And which is what I ended up doing too. I did actually read the whole thing. But at a certain point, I was like, I'm just going to be looking at the storytelling and seeing how it goes. There's a lot here that, you know, isn't terribly important. And I was forming a lot of, I was sort of noting a lot of the stylistic things that were A, different from now, and B, that, you know, Neil Adams really excels at. Mm-hmm. I think, if nothing else, I think the thing that stands out more than anything is two things. There's the layouts, which is funny because sometimes the layouts are incredibly dynamic and sometimes they're pretty straightforward. This first story is pretty much squared off grids. Mm-hmm. There's a little bit of panel breaking, and the action that happens between them is dynamic. But man, his, like, action poses when Batman would be kicking or swinging on his rope, or, you know, when he's fighting the cheetah.
Yep.
People don't do it like that anymore.
No, his body language is wholly his own.
It works. Figure drawing and perspective. Yeah, totally. Yeah.
There's just ways that people are oriented. You know, there's a scene on page 22 where Batman's pushing two guards aside. It's just a very unusual body language. There's one scene in one of the issues where Batman is, like, knocked out, and the camera's really low on the floor, and it's just him splayed out. It's just so... It's a very non-heroic pose.
I noticed that a bunch of times. He was real... Like, when he did a thing of somebody being knocked out and, like, sort of, like laying out on the floor. Yeah. There's one where, like, both of his legs were sort of in front of him, like he was laying down. And I just thought, wow, his anatomy is excellent.
Yeah.
Really good. And then you've got that sort of... That Dick Giordano inking with that sort of Al Williamson, it's my favorite thing, because the comics used to all look like this or attempt it, and no one does it like this anymore. And I do like the fact that there are different art styles available, and there's, you know, many shades of excellent, but there is something about the way that, you know, they draw those ridges between the muscles and the hatch marks and the, you know, the way that the cape is drawn that is just so, you know, this is comic book to me.
Yes, and I think you see the value of an inker, especially in that period of time where Giordano's inking over Neil Adams is better than Adams on his own, as was Klaus Janson over Frank Miller.
Yeah.
You know, it was a team back then for a reason, in an era where inkers are fast disappearing.
Yeah, I mean, Jimmy Palmiotti over Joe Quesada comes to mind. Palmiotti is a classic inker.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. And then, you know, you see what Neil Adams does now, and I kind of wonder, well, like, is this age and shortcuts, or is this, you know, this is what he wants to do, and I don't think it helps.
It's probably both, you know.
Yeah, he's very old. I'm not sure.
But styles also change as they get older. And ironically, this week we have a Neil Adams book, you know, another issue of his Batman series out now, but it doesn't look like this. The foundations are there, but Giordano polishes it up in a really beautiful way.
I think, and there's bits going through here where there's some of this just sloppy, or it feels it, and I'm wondering if that's a reproduction thing.
I don't know.
Some of it is crystal clear and beautiful, and, you know, the facial acting and just all the details are really beautiful. And then there's others where it just looks like big blotches of ink. You know, like some of the Joker faces for some reason are really odd.
Yeah, it's hard to know. The second story, the Two-Face story, this one was in the Greatest Batman Stories Ever Told collection. So I have read this one a lot.
The Revenge of the... No, I never had the Greatest Batman Stories. I had the Greatest Joker Stories. So I had read the five...
There's a Joker one later that's in the Joker collection. But this one, this Two-Face one, is definitely in the greatest... One of the volumes, either volume one or volume two. I remember the Mustard Lady... And then Batman scaring the guy who talks about how he beat Batman up if you ever saw him. So this one I'd read before. His Two-Face is terrific. It made me think about Two-Face because he has morphed over the time. Here, he's just a man with a scarred half face because he had acid thrown in it. Now he's a guy who his entire body seems to be scarred on the left side, even his hand and his neck and his hair. And which doesn't make any sense from his origin, but that's the way he's done now. I think it was the influence of the Batman the Animated Series cartoon, which gave him a green hand, too. But here it's just a man who, from behind, would look like any other man, except that his face is all scarred on one side. And that's something that his character has changed a lot over the years.
I think what was interesting in that one is that this version, and I don't know who can say how much of this is canon. They'd all have to be 150 years old.
Right.
But he had been, like Bruce Wayne had repaired him and fixed him, and then he got injured, like another freak accident happened.
Yeah, that happens a lot with Two-Face. A lot of plastic surgery.
And I thought that, because at first, I don't know if I'd missed the first bit, and I was like, wait a minute, that's not how he was injured. And I went back and it said, oh, no, that's the courtroom. The courtroom thing happened, and everything after that gets kind of fuzzy.
There's a very classic Batman panel. There's a couple of, like, really classic imagery. One is that image of Batman running in the Joker story, where he's like, it's a very long angle shot of him.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
In a Two-Face one on page 40, it's him looking at the camera and sort of starting to clench his fist, but he's only in the process of doing it, you know, being very angsty about
40?
What's going on. Page 40 in your digital reader.
I'm sorry, the bottom
panel. That's a very classic Batman image.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, you're right.
And then the caption asks if we have figured out the mystery yet. This is still that era where they would talk to you in the caption.
I love
sometimes.
That. I hadn't.
I hadn't either. And I'm a much older person than I was back then. What's interesting about this era is that comics are still ostensibly for kids, but I think they discovered in the 60s with Marvel that a lot of adults were still reading their books. So you've got this middle ground in the storytelling where it's still supposedly made for children, but it's sophisticated enough for adults for the most part.
As you get to this part that we're talking about in through this, and then that sort of Halloween costume story that comes after that,
right,
you start to notice the elongation of Batman. Like, he seems to get taller and not necessarily leaner, but just like muscular and long, there's an actor I can't think of, the vampire, the sexy vampire, who's a Skarsgård, whichever he
is.
Alex Skarsgård. Right. You know, like, he, and his face is sort of longer and taller. And when I think of Neil Adams, I always think of sort of like a three-quarter view of the side of Batman's mask.
Mm-hmm.
And his face just looks long, and he has very cut jawbones. And, you know, now he doesn't quite have that.
Yeah, that lasted through Jim Aparo.
Yep.
In that kind of era where Batman was a long and lean guy, and now he's sort of like, you know, a giant muscular dude.
Yeah.
Not that he wasn't muscular before, but he was definitely more of like an acrobatic type of character. I loved that story talking about the Halloween one, Night of the Reaper, in which many Marvel characters make appearances because it's Halloween, and Dick Grayson in college with his vest. So in this era, Dick Grayson has been aged up into a college age. So he's away a lot, but also reappears a lot. There's a whole story with him and his college friends, and I loved the one college friend who is clearly high out of his gourd, but they can't out and say it. Who is really obsessed with floats, and asks everybody that he meets what they think about floats. Even in the midst of fistfights, it was really funny.
And also just when he's walking around by himself thinking, he says, man, I just got to find someone to rap with about floats. All this shit's going down. He just wants floats, man.
This is also the 70s, so this feels of a time in the culture, because the language is very 70s, especially with the kids. Mm-hmm. There's a costume party. There's a giant guy dressed as Thor, and then there's Spider-Man. And
it's a brooding Solomon Grundy. And then Havoc for some reason, because Neil Adams knows that stuff.
I just thought this was a really fun story and wacky, and and it involves a Nazi? Yeah, an old Nazi.
Yeah. Well, he's a concentration camp survivor, the killer.
Right.
And so he goes to find there's a Nazi that he's getting his revenge on who had escaped justice.
That's right. And then a tragic ending in a very 70s way, where the Star of David necklace on the guy's with the kill distracts him and he falls to his death. And then there's a very dramatic shot of him dead with the Star of David necklace next to him. And it was very, ironic ending death. And the heartbreak of Batman's face in the previous panel is really terrific. I thought this was a really great story.
Yeah. And in the way that it's of a time, and it's really interesting and probably quite forward for that time. The art is the whole way through. Every time I look at the art, I'm like, wow, he was hitting on another level. And you go, oh, I see where John Byrne comes from. That sort of straight line.
The next story, I think we return to Ra's al Ghul. Yeah, we do.
Oh, man.
And with the ski, Olympic ski woman.
Everything about that was great. This is a James Bond story.
Yeah.
1000%. Batman is on skis in it. And you've got this guy. Who's the dude? The martial arts guy?
I don't know. Just some guy.
Ling. And I loved that because it was like a Wookiee life debt.
Right.
He owes a life debt to both Batman. And also, Robin is playing matches Malone, which is fantastic.
In an inflatable bodysuit.
Yep. He has a life debt to Batman and to Ra's al Ghul, so then they have to fight so that Ling can figure out who he's supposed to go with, and he ends up going to Batman. Then they meet this Olympic skier in her sexy bodysuit, and it's great.
She helps them with their adventure, beating dudes up. And
she learned a thing or two being an international Olympic skier.
This is the introduction of the Lazarus Pit, I believe.
I think so, yeah.
And also the continuation of Batman and Ubu's rivalry for the affections of Ra's al Ghul.
Here's the thing, though. Batman is obsessed with thinking that Ubu is fat. Ubu is a well-conditioned man.
Yeah.
He's not fat. And so if he thinks that guy's fat, what does Batman think of you?
Exactly. So in the one scene, he knocks Ubu out. He sits over him going, he'll sleep the sleep of the fat, ugly, and stupid. I was like, Jesus, Batman. He really hates Ubu in a way I've never read before.
Yeah, it's kind of fun. There's a couple bits where Batman is skiing, and I was just like, well, that's something Neil Adams can't draw. He can't draw Batman skiing very well, which doesn't take away from it almost adds to its wonder.
Oh, the page I was thinking about was page 99 in that story, the next issue, in which Batman has been knocked out, and it's just this very unheroic shot of him. He's like, ass and his legs, and they're all crumpled. And it's a very natural.
Yeah, that's literally it. That's the one. Yeah, his knees aren't aligned, so he's just down. And that I was like, wow, that's a wonderful bit of figure drawing.
And that's something that wouldn't happen even now. It's totally anatomically correct, but he doesn't look heroic, so nobody would draw a character that way now. And that still shows you how good Neil Adams was and why he is totally deserving of the place he's been put into in the art echelon. But yeah, this was super fun. This was Batman as James Bond. This is the kind of story that Grant Morrison had said he wanted to do when he originally came back to Batman back, 10 years ago, was this globetrotting Batman who always ends up with his shirt off fighting somebody, but with the rest of the outfit on. And I don't know how that works.
I'm looking at that same page that we were just talking about, and I don't understand the physics of Ra's al Ghul's pants.
I don't know what holds him up.
That's it points at his butt crack, and I was like, I'm not in this good shape, but I've worn pants. And that's not how that works unless there's some sort of adhesive involved.
There's the spirit gum. But this is also, you've got manly, hairy chest Batman. Mm-hmm. This is not waxed like a baby seal, got man's body. This is he takes off that shirt to fight Ra's al Ghul in the desert. And it's Tom Selleck.
And also sexy Jodhpur's Talia. who's at some point her shirt is way up high, showing the midriff, and at other points it literally stops right under where her bra would be, and then other things it covers her all the way up. It's all that shirt's all over the place in this. Actually, this is a really good example of look at most of it. So look at page 110.
You're talking about the final page? Yeah, 110, 111, yeah.
Yeah, it's very, it's almost like they...
111 looks like it was drawn very hastily.
It looks like it was one panel that they blew up to fill the page.
Yeah, maybe.
I don't know. It's just less resolution.
That's definitely true. The leg looks weird, Batman's leg. It almost doesn't look like it's Neil Adams at all.
No. And that kind of stuff sort of happened in and out through the whole thing. And I really do have a feeling that that has a lot to do with production, because you've got pages that are much higher quality than others.
I don't
others.
Think that is Neil Adams. It looks like it's...
It's weird, right?
It doesn't look like him, though. I'd love to find the original issue of this and compare.
Yeah, and also, like, I just wish that they were a little more straightforward with, tell me what the production, you know, tell me who colored it. Tell me who, we had to do production assist somewhere.
Right.
Because I think you're right. Like, I don't think there's any way to view this. Yeah, I don't know. I was going to say there's no way to view this other than a historical document, but maybe they do, a kid goes and buys it and then likes to read it just like we would have. Right. I guess that's possible. But I can't imagine that's the bulk of the market they're actually selling them to.
No, for sure. Let's jump ahead a little bit. There's the story about Bruce Wayne thinking he's dead. That was all right. Mm-hmm. Then there's a Joker story. You're right. There's a couple of pages on here where the Joker's face is really strange. I'm looking at page 134. The guy is clearly Neil Adams, but it almost looks like current Neil Adams. Like he redrew the page.
Mm-hmm. I bet. You know what? I bet that's what's happening. I bet they're having him do the fixes where they need it.
Because this doesn't look at all like the rest of the book, this page. But it does look like the current stuff Neil Adams is doing, so I wonder if he redrew this.
Mm-hmm.
So that's interesting.
This is the one where he fights the shark, which has always stuck with me. Batman fights a tiger shark
right.
with a chain. And I also thought, you'd never do this story today because you couldn't kill a shark.
You know what? A lot of this... So... Page 139 with the famous image of Joker stepping on Batman. Again, that looks like modern Neil Adams, especially the Joker face in the corner. That's not period Neil Adams.
That's in my greatest Joker stories ever told. I could get that out and compare, which was printed probably 30.
And also, I noticed a lot of these imagery from this period were used for the DC superheroes dictionary that I had, that I did a Fanboy Mini on, but you can no longer see unless we get the next stretch goal on our Patreon. But a lot of these images were taken from Neil Adams. I saw a couple of them in this collection.
Page 149 is one of the most iconic Batman images ever.
I'm looking through this. I'm thinking that he redrew a lot of pages in the story. Maybe the pages were lost.
Yeah, or they were just...
damaged, or they were just not good enough.
Or they only had pencils or something.
There's no way this is original Neil Adams in a lot of this. Mm-hmm. Yeah, 149 is one of the most iconic Batman images ever.
Absolutely. Then you have the werewolf story.
Yeah, I didn't like that one so much.
I kind of did in that, it wasn't straightforward,
mm-hmm.
It was very silly. I love that the fact that the bad guy had that really bad bowl haircut. I feel like a lot of bad guys used to look like that, like weasel bowl haircut guys.
Right.
And their plan was terrible. Plan was to tell Bruce Wayne that he'd only donate to the charity if Batman came by his house to pick it up. And he's like, would you like a drink, Batman? And then he had drugged the drink. And I was like, who think he's going to have the drink? I like that it was ridiculous. It wasn't good. It doesn't hold up well, but it is really funny.
And also, I think it's important. These aren't necessarily chronological. They're not 10 issues in a row. They pick and choose. It was highlights from that run.
Yeah, and I think that's fine. And then the last two are from, I guess, the collected, you get the comic book and a record.
Yeah, so this is important to talk about because these are very different than what comes before.
Yeah.
So the book and record set, it's fun to read as you hear. There's two stories from this set. You bought a little record. Was it a 45? Was that what it was called?
Yeah.
And you got a comic book that you could read along with. First of all, you can find these on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
They're there. I found the Man-Bat one. It's full production, sound effects and...
I bet they made $1 million from this.
Probably. And so Neil Adams wrote and drew these. And from the style of the writing and definitely from listening to it, it's very much trying to recapture Batman 66. So the style is totally different. These were squarely aimed at children. And I'm curious as to why they put these in other than as a interesting historical artifact, because they are not in the more sophisticated style of the previous stories. These are squarely aimed at kids.
It said that Neil Adams wrote those, so maybe he wanted them included. But this actually lends credence to the historical document,
right?
Idea, because this is, if you're being completist, if you're like, well, he wrote these, fuck, maybe he's proud of them. Maybe he's like, you should put those in. I wrote those.
He shouldn't necessarily not be if they were children's stories. Sure. And this is like, you know, there's a red phone the commissioner has in his office. He has an Irish cop sidekick who isn't called Chief. Why am I not remembering the chief's name from the show? Oh, God.
In this, the man bat, Kirk Langstrom, is really more of a good guy. Is that?
Well, that's kind of what he is.
But the best part of all that, though, is that besides the fact that he looks about five different people in a little flashback to his life.
Chief O'Hara. God damn it.
Oh, yeah. Apparently, when Kurt Langstrom would work in his laboratory, he would wear a cape with a chain and a collar.
Well, you got to be ready for your transformation into a supervillain.
I guess so.
It's very much recapturing something from 10 years ago. At the time this was published.
Right.
It was the dynamic of the show. Batman and Robin's relationship was more like the show. The dialogue was a bit, you know, more, I don't say clunky, but more of that.
Yeah.
The Batman dialogue in the show was intentionally square. You know, he was intentionally written as a square to contrast the villains. And so here we have that. So it's a little jarring to read, especially after the previous stories. I liked reading them, but these were hard to read.
Yeah. I will say, throughout the whole thing, these stories included, you know, at the end, anytime Robin shows up, it was better.
Yes, 100%.
Like, every time, you know, and I found that really interesting because we don't experience that in the same way. They don't go on missions together. I feel like I've only ever seen Batman alone or sort of grudgingly working with people or, you know, Superman will drop by. Like, you know, him and Robin going out and doing stuff. And, you know, I can 100% see why you liked, you know, the Dick Grayson Robin character so much. If this was the kind of thing you were reading, like it really rounded things out in a way that, you know, still worked.
And ironically, it was Neil Adams who was tangentially involved in the change. So that change came about with Tim Drake. Mm-hmm. Neil Adams designed Tim Drake's costume. And you see the famous drawing of it in the back of this collection. Mm-hmm. That was a poster that I had. Dick Grayson and then Jason Todd, they were the sidekicks. They didn't have their own books, and they were in his missions, and they weren't always in them, but they were always there. And then Tim comes along, and they decide to give him his own comic and his own adventures. And basically since that time, which was the early 90s, he hasn't really been a constant presence in Batman's life and adventures. Yeah. Now, Damian has been a bit more. They had the Batman and Robin book for a little while. But Batman and Robin, the teen wonder, as said in the covers here, is not really the dynamic anymore. And it's a bummer because you're right. It is way better when Robin is with him.
Yeah. So did Neil Adams design that Tim Drake costume?
Yes.
That's a great costume.
Yes. I mean, I prefer the original, but yes. Before we talk about that, I just want to mention there was something I legitimately laughed at in these stories. Page 188 with the Joker where he's going to get away from Batman, so he jumps from the pier into the water.
Mm-hmm.
But it's low tide. And so he's stuck, and then you turn the page, and the reveal of him sort of stuck in the diving pose in the mud was so ridiculous that it made me laugh.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so Neil Adams, he did. So there's two of these. There's the Joker one, the Man Bat one. The Man Bat one, I probably enjoyed less because I just never really cared about Man Bat. He's kind of like he's like the lizard for Spider-Man. I just don't really care.
Yeah,
but you know there are things to appreciate. And as you mentioned to me, the whole thing is about Robin meets the Man Bat. I think that's the name of the story.
Yeah.
So Batman introduces him twice.
Yes.
To the Man-Bat. Yeah, Robin meets Man-Bat is the name of the book, is the name of the story.
Yeah, Robin complains. Maybe you should introduce him, so he introduces them again. That's like me and about, well, there's a specific comic creator who I've been introduced to 1,000 times.
I can't say this enough. It sounds silly, but man, this cover gallery from page 215 whatever, it's terrific.
245. And it really is. I mean, it's a tablet background bonanza.
You're right.
One, by the way, my favorite is on page 230.
Okay.
It's Batman looking at a body on a gurney under a sheet, and he says on the left side as we go left to right, because that's how comics work, "Professor, I swear I'll avenge your death." And as you move to the right, you see a brain in a jar on a pedestal, and it says, "I'm not dead, Ben."
How much you want to read that issue?
I really want to read that issue. And then the sheet actually just says DOA on it, in case you weren't sure. That's a corpse.
Yeah, I mean,
it begs so many questions.
It's great. And it's almost like this is the real historical record. This really gives you a sense of the era of all these different kind of stories. And there's a World's Finest one with Superman and Batman. Where Batman's flying. He's saying up, up, and away. And Superman's crashing, saying, "What's happening to me? I can't fly anymore." I want to read that one.
Yep. You know what sucks about these covers, though?
What?
They took the prices off all of them.
Why?
Why indeed?
Why did they? I didn't notice that. But why did they do that?
Interesting. I mean, literally, like, the idea of being able to see the prices is interesting, because I'm reading and I thought somebody paid 15 cents for this or a quarter or whatever. And then you go through these at the end and they've decided that for some reason there's a political marketing reason or something that they shouldn't put the prices on there. And that's insane.
I didn't notice that before, but that is crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Each circle where the price would be is either blank or it has the 48 pages, and then below it is all blank.
Yeah.
52 big pages. Don't take less, blank.
Yep.
Wow, wow, wow. There's some really interesting decision-making here.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. And, you know, I don't understand. You know, I don't think, okay, just you know, like, there's a lot of people like, ugh, Didio. You know, this doesn't make it up to Dan Didio's desk. This is not a thing that has to do with that. But it feels like there's an overall sort of corporate culture of extreme caution.
It's so weird.
It is. It's not like the information is not available. Right. You know?
Even the more modern stuff, because it starts going into the 90s. There's the Batman Annual 14 from 1990 that Neil Adams did the cover for. That one doesn't have a cover price on it. So,
by the way, that one has internal art by Chris Sprouse, so it probably looks awesome.
I remember that one. I have that one.
Sure you do.
So then page 248, that's the famous drawing that Neil Adams did of the new Robin costume that was included with, as a poster, I believe, with the first issue of Robin, like a mini poster.
Chuck Dixon write that?
Yeah.
That before him.
Yeah, Pin Up for Robin number one. Yeah, that was November 1991. That was when Tim Drake came about. And that's when it changed. That's when everything changed and Robin became a solo character. As a kid, didn't like it, but man, it's a good costume.
Yep. Oh, it's a fine costume. It's a really good update, you know, on the old one, which doesn't sort of lend itself to the how come he has boy panties on, you know, but still has the same idea.
And then you can see how his art changes as you get further on and 2005, 2009 especially, you can see how his style has changed in the DC Universe Illustrated by Neil Adams Volume 1 collection cover they have here. Not bad, but different. And the sketchbook, yep, which is interesting too in the back, where there's a lot of... Neil Adams has done a lot of... He's done a lot of commercial art. He's in addition to comic artists, he's a commercial illustrator. And so here he's done a lot of like design work for DC, like designing their rides at amusement parks and designing commercial stuff that we've never seen before that's in the back here that's interesting, as well as like consumer products artwork.
Oh, yeah, he's done a ton of stuff. You can hear this little bio of him on the back sort of gives you a very basic idea of sort of the kind of stuff that he did. But, you know, like he's still a working artist.
Mm-hmm. Oh, for
sure. You know, done all sorts of things. Like he's from, you know, the time where, you know, he worked. Like I'm almost sure that the reason that he's inking his own stuff now is just like, I don't want to pay another guy. I'll just do it.
Yeah.
Like I feel like there's a old school practicality to him as a person.
I had a lot of fun reading it. So I'm curious what you felt overall reading it. If you enjoyed it, if you think the 70s idea is a good one, should we toss it?
I don't really want to do a theme, but I find that we fall into them one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll figure out what the
next
thing is.
We're not going to do all 70s books. I think there's some other things we'll look at. But for the most part, we thought we would look at this era of books.
I thought it was interesting. I didn't have as much fun reading this as I did the last sort of Kirby Stan, it was a bunch of people, the Fantastic Four stuff we read, the Galactus stuff.
Right.
It took me a little longer to get into it, for sure. When I got into a rhythm by the end, I was having fun with it, for sure. Mm-hmm. I don't know that I would really pick this up on my own as be like, this is a thing. But there's value in it. It's, you know, for a person like, for people like us who talk about comics and think about them like that, you know, the more we know, the better. You know, like, I feel like it adds to my overall perspective for what comics are. And, you know, a lot of this is the nascent version of who Batman is in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is, you know, I'm going to say... that outside of sort of the cartoons that we would see occasionally and, you know, the Batman TV show, which I never really liked,
mm-hmm,
that sort of greatest Joker stories, greatest Batman stories ever told, those are my introduction to a lot of this.
Right.
And so this is right there. You know, and also when you read that book, that was the point where I felt like I wasn't reading something from a billion years ago for kids. That was the point where, like, ooh.
Yeah.
Yeah, like as you hit the Neil Adams stuff, late 60s, 70s, like that was the point where I was like, oh, these look cool. This is exactly, you know, and now I look at it differently. I look at that old stuff and I'd say, oh, I see what's cool about that. But when I was a kid, this was when I thought, oh, these are the real deal here. You know, it's these stories.
People talk about Dark Knight Returns being the place where Batman became modern. And it's true, but the process began here. He's not totally modern here, for sure. He's definitely in the Bronze Age. But when you compare it to the Silver Age, it's definitely a step forward in terms of modernizing the character in the world. It's still very speak out loud what you're doing, all that stuff, but we're taking steps in the right direction. That brings us to The Dark Knight Returns, which brings us to the modern age of Batman, and especially the look and feel of it, where everything looks more realistic and people look more realistic. I enjoyed reading it. I definitely enjoyed reading it. So that's Batman by Neil Adams, book three, the February Booksplode. Are we doing ratings? I guess we're doing ratings on it.
I mean,
it's hard to rate.
It is. How do you determine a qualitative, you know, like what's, you know, is it in context? Is it, you know, if you've got this and a modern comic book by a, you know, by a modern master, how do you compare the two?
But I think it's even like even internally, it's three different things. It's the comics, and then it's the kids' books in the, at the end, and then it's the awesome cover gallery. So it's three different sections almost, even within the book itself. So I'm going to have to rate it as an overall experience.
Yeah, I think that's the best way to go.
And overall, I'm going to give it a 4 out of 5. Because the stuff I did enjoy reading, I really enjoyed reading. And there were some things I didn't enjoy reading.
Yeah. I think I'm going to say 3.5. And I think that half star definitely is the difference between you and I.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, I don't know, we rated the last one, the Fantastic Four one. But I was very high. I would have been very high with it.
Yeah, I think we did 5. I think we did 5.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
So, and that's about right.
So there you go. If you have thoughts on these books, you can go to ifmo.com and tell us what you thought. If you have memories of reading Neil Adams' books at the time, or if you've discovered them later on, or if you have any thoughts, or if you know why they took the price off the covers, or if Neil Adams redrew some of these pages, which we suspect he did, you can find all this discussion of this book over at ifmo.com. You can also find all of our podcasts, our weekly Pick of the Week show, in which Josh and I discuss the week's comics, and our special edition shows where we talk about movies and other things that are outside of the purview of weekly comics. It's all there. And this show is the companion show to the Talksplode show, in which Josh interviews a comic creator. Last month, Josh, you interviewed whom?
Matthew Rosenberg of some indie comics like Four Kids Walk Into a Bank, and then also a lot of Marvel comics.
And you'll be back next month or this month with a new interview.
This month. There's going to be a February one.
So there you go. All that's at ifanboy.com. Thank you for listening, and thanks for unlocking this show, patrons. We enjoy doing it. And until next time, I'm Connor.
I can't believe you didn't introduce me to Man-Bat.
Josh, this is Man-Bat and his
you.
Wife.
When are you going to introduce me to Man-Bat?
Oh, sorry, Josh, this is Man-Bat.
That's, I mean, like, I don't know how many people listening read the book or looked at it, but they're like, what are they talking about now?
Read the book, you'll know.
Yeah, it's true. It's, I mean, it's not a good story, but still, it's funny.
You just call up my name, and you know wherever I am, I'll come running. Oh, yes, I will see you again. Winter, spring, summer, or fall. All you got to do is call, and I'll be there, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Batman, can you ever forgive me?
I already have, Francine.
Well, I may never forgive you, Batman. Not unless you get around to introducing me to your friends.
Sorry, Robin. Kurt, Francine, I'd like you to meet my protege and junior partner.
This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. How's your social battery doing right now? I've never used that phrase, but I instantly know what it means, and I think it's interesting because it works two different ways. Some people need to have their social battery charged, and they this is the introvert-extrovert thing, and some people, you know, like, they've got enough energy for other people, but then it's time to sort of step away, and, you know, as we get to this part where winter is ending, which, again, it's opposite. I love winter. I don't need it to end. You know, you start getting together with more people, and it can be a little draining on top of every other thing that we all have going on in our lives. I just assume everybody's overburdened because I think everybody's overburdened. But it can be tough to deal with. And also, like, one of the things is, like, you can't necessarily understand why you feel that way or why it's making you tired, but it's a real thing. If you think that you could use some help with it, if you could figure out a way to make things better, therapy is a great way to help. It can give you that kind of self-awareness to know how to ride that level just right so that you feel good, you feel right. If you're thinking of starting therapy, you can give BetterHelp a try. It is entirely online. It is designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule, which is, again, we've been talking about being busy, right? You got to fit that in. You got a lunch period. You can do it during that time, whichever. That's possible. You fill out a brief questionnaire and get matched with a licensed therapist. You can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. I like that. There is no penalty for finding the person who is right for you. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/iFanboy today. Get 10% off of your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/iFanboy.